Music there from John Zorn and Masada with Joey Barron on drums, Greg Cohen on bass, Dave Douglas on trumpet, and of course John Zorn on alto saxophone. Welcome to A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. My name is Michael Bates. This is a special episode of the podcast. We have part two of an interview that happened between Dave Douglas and John Zorn back on September 12th at the WNYU studios. Very excited to hear more of what they had to say. Hey, if you like these interviews, please stop past the iTunes website and leave us a rating and review. That helps people find information about what we do. Previous episodes of the podcast with interviews from Myra Melford, Matt Mitchell, John Robigon, and a whole bunch more. We'd love to hear your comments and questions, suggestions, anything. Please get in touch with us at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. You can also find these episodes at greenleafmusic.com, and that's a company that Dave runs. And you can find sheet music, blog posts, recordings by Dave, Donnie McCaslin, who incidentally has just been nominated for a Grammy. Linda O is up there, Matt Ullery. I've released a couple of records on Greenleaf, and there's a whole bunch more. Kneebody, tons of great stuff. If you visit now, there's a special offer on Dave Douglas's DD50 box set with the three CDs celebrating Dave's 50th birthday. There's a DVD with some session footage, a bunch of stuff. And now here is part two of the interview between Dave Douglas and John Zorn, and Dave picks up asking John about being a saxophone player.
You said a lot in interviews about your vocabulary as a player, that you practiced a lot back in the day, and then you got to where you wanted to be on the saxophone, and then you stopped practicing. And so all that vocabulary comes out of that time in your life when you probably did just practice obsessively all the time, right?
Pretty much, yeah.
I mean, what were you practicing? What were you doing? Where were you living, first of all?
Well,
that your neighbors didn't come and...
that is an issue, and we don't have to go into the details of that.
Sounds good.
But I picked up the horn when I was in. I went to St. Louis for a year or so to go to school, mm-hmm. Webster College, and Oliver Lake was teaching there. Hemphill was teaching there. Marty
Julius
Ehrlich was
Hemphill.
In St. Louis at the time.
Marty Ehrlich.
Julius Hemphill, and. Luther Thomas was in school. I think he was in my same grade. And there was a lot of excitement at that time. This is 71, 2, 3, with the Black Arts Group in Chicago and the AACM. I mean, AACM in Chicago, Black Arts Group in St. Louis. Mm-hmm. Sun Ra was traveling around, and I heard For Alto by Braxton. Mm. And I'd been writing classical and just trying to, you know, turn the flame up on that music to get more passion, more intensity. And then when I heard Braxton and a lot of Leo Smith, Roscoe Mitchell, and the Sun Ra Orchestra, I began to see that improvisation was a way of really getting that edge, getting that intensity, getting that passion happening.
But before you went to St. Louis, you were already playing saxophone?
No. I picked up the horn when I was, I believe I picked it up when I was in St. Louis.
So those early pieces that you've released are... it's just electronics and stuff that you were doing here before you went away to college.
Some of them. And some of them had the beginnings of my sax playing.
Uh-huh. Okay.
You know, the very beginnings of the sax playing.
But the big practicing happened.
Big practicing started then. Started then, you know, from 72 to 82. 10 years of obsessive practice, 10 hours a day, mm-hmm. Practicing to records, playing long tones, I never really practiced extended techniques so much. That I found was best interacting with other people. I'd find people to play with, and we'd improvise. And in a way, I saw the saxophone, or being an instrumentalist, I saw as a way of meeting people, as a way of kind of a calling card, a way of saying, hey, you know, let's get together and play. You know, a composer comes by and says, hey, let's get together and you play my piece. It's kind of a drag. So I thought, you know, if for me to play an instrument uh-huh. is a way of meeting people. And I did meet people. We'd meet people. I'd meet people on the street. I'd hear people playing a monk tune out of a window. And I'd go and go knock on the door. Hey, man, you're into monk. Let's get together.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. So you could have picked guitar or...
Well, I played guitar when I was younger.
Or, yeah, all the instruments you were playing on those early recordings. and you ended up obsessing on the alto sax.
On the alto sax. And for whatever reason, it became a voice.
But did the duck calls come later?
They came much later. Uh-huh. They came in the later 70s as just, you know, a way of expanding the language, the reed language. You have to remember that a duck call often uses a reed. It's a reed instrument. And now I'm playing the organ a lot, but I'm playing the pipe organ, which also is a wind instrument.
Right.
It needs to have wind going through it. And a lot of those pipes have reeds. So this is all kind of related to the wind tradition, the reed tradition.
Right.
And the game calls. The game calls came maybe 78, 77, 76.
Right. So the obsessive practicing of the alto saxophone, you said
10 hours
tones.
A day. Yeah.
Playing along with records.
Yeah, improvising, always improvising.
Improvising.
Not reading written music. I never like to do that on the horn.
No etudes, no classical etudes.
A little bit here and there, but, you know, Bach, you know, a little bit of, you know, the Bach flute things and this and that. But in general, you know, I'd write down solos off of records, you know, try to play along with those. It was more improvising. Really, I would say 90% of what I did on the horn, if not more, was improvising in my practice method.
But did you have, like, so a time management perspective? I mean, 10 hours is a long time.
My time management was very unique. My time management was I took the horn into the bathroom with me because I didn't want to waste any time. And I got so obsessive that, you know, I'd be playing, you know, while I was taking a leak.
Oh, man.
And eventually I started really realizing, well, you know, I played for 10 hours, but I probably breathed for 4 hours of that, you know, or 3 hours was I stopped and I took a breath.
Like that was a waste.
Yeah, yeah. The breathing was a waste. So that's when I started the circular breathing.
Oh.
You know, they really, you know, it was obsessive is the word. And one day I woke up and I said, you know, it's a beautiful day.
Right.
I'm going to go out and my practice method is now going to be living life. Going to a movie is going to be practicing. Going to a museum is going to be practicing. Going for a bike ride is going to be practicing. And I'm never going to practice the horn this way again.
But in terms of the 10 hours, I mean, was that a specific number for you? Or you?
It was 8, 10. It was all day. As soon as I got up, I'd pull it out. And it was all day, you know.
And you would just be improvising. But you must have, like, you'd come across an idea, a sound idea that you'd want to get more deeply into. So
always.
The idea of improvising in your practice became an exploration of different ways of playing, and then you would focus intently on things that maybe you couldn't do that you thought might be possible.
I think that period of focus happened on stage.
Huh.
Happened on stage.
In that same time?
In the same time period, we were, you know, or on stage or on stage in, you know, kind
right.
of
playing
in
with
brackets.
People
playing with yeah. people is when the sonic explorations really went to another level. I didn't sit at home and then practice double tonguing, practice multiphonics, practice right. you know, controlling
altissimo,
squeaks and altissimo. Yeah. I didn't really do that, you know, finding, you know, other kinds of fingerings and what have you. That all happened kind of in the heat of performance, playing with people, jamming. That's when that language kind of got developed. And pretty much when I was home practicing, it was the TV playing and me doing long tones or a record playing and me playing along with the record. There was always something else going on. I never played alone, the saxophone by itself, the only sound happening.
Huh.
There was always another sound happening.
But do you think that, like, in these moments where you were playing with other people where you would drive, you know, push yourself into these new territories, would you then the next day go, oh, there was that thing that I tried to do last night, let me go back and figure out what that is?
No.
Or was it was just in the moment?
Always in the moment, and I would remember it.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, I didn't like to write everything down because I felt if it was important enough, I would remember it. So,
but that's so different than your approach to composition. I mean, you have notebooks and you have a big chalkboard.
Yep.
And you have everything like super organized.
Yes.
And that's the only way you could run Sodic and
yep.
do all the pieces that you do. So in your playing, there was never anything on paper.
In my playing, it was always, it was a matter of catharsis. It was a matter of, you know, kind of emotional intensity.
Wow.
That's the way I play. It never became a pedagogy. It never became rigid. It never became something that I could then teach to someone else. It was something that happened in kind of an emotional crucible. Mm. And yes, that's very opposite from the way I compose, which is, very worked out and very,
organized.
Organized, very organized.
I always assumed that your approach to vocabulary on the instrument was similarly organized.
Well, there was a time in, say, 75, 6, 7, 8, when I really started developing the extended techniques on the horn, where I would make posters for concerts. And some of the posters would be graphs, where there would be little kind of graphic symbols of my saxophone language. Mm. You know, the wind squeak, the harmonics, the multiphonics, this, that, and the other. But that was never anything that I used as a score. That was never anything that I used as any kind of reminder of a vocabulary. It was something I did just graphically to make a poster. Mm. But it was not written down as a lexicon or a dictionary of sounds. Everything, all of that, the whole improvisational side of my work is left for the ether.
Well, it was just in your head.
In my head, in my genes.
You just reeled off the names of five
sounds that we used,
areas,
that we used to kind of joke about, when I want to harness a certain sound in a compositional format, like when Chadbourne was saying, do that thing you do. And I say, oh, you mean the wind squeak. Weak, like this kind of thing. And some of the sounds kind of were very unique, and I had little names for them. And Chadbourne and I had all kinds of little private language about different things like that.
Right.
So, but again, it was never regimented. It was never made into any kind of pedagogy.
Well, how much of your inspiration as a composer then comes out of that place that sounds like a very intuitive, primal sort of, not written down?
I'm not sure what to say about that. I don't. Maybe that's for someone else to answer. Maybe none. Maybe it's there somewhere.
But the experience, the physical experience of performing and playing the saxophone.
Well, what that did for me as a composer is made me understand what a performer likes to do.
Interesting.
I think it's very important. And I think many of the greatest composers have been performers. I think it's important to understand what it is to be on stage. I think for a composer not to have that experience, not to know what that is I think you're going to miss out on a lot. And I feel like my composition has very much been influenced and affected by the fact that I'm a performer, but not on a surface level in terms of the sound or the approach. Although, as you know, a lot of times I work in blocks.
Yeah.
When I'm improvising, I'll return to certain sounds at different times, almost in an attempt to structure an improvisation in some kind of a way and make a compositional statement out of it.
Right.
And in my written composition, it also, works in blocks, and at times, the blocks develop in an organic way and never repeat, and at times they do come back and repeat. Mm. So I think there's music techniques that I use both in improvising and in composing. I don't know if that is quite what you were asking.
Well, it's such a big topic. I'm not sure that we're going to solve it here.
It is interesting.
What seems interesting to me, having played a lot of your music, or having played the Masada books with you, is that the composing is so methodical and so coming out of an intense awareness of your inner language and your resources, and a really focused use of an incredibly broad but incredibly well-organized set of parameters. And so I just always assumed that the improvising was coming from the same place. It seems of a piece.
I think my head is definitely
just
of
the way
a piece.
That you work.
I think
definitely of a piece.
I'm definitely of a piece.
I don't know of what, but
I think that my conception is the same with my composing and my improvising. I think the same way. But
yeah,
I think the approach. I think what we've explored in this conversation that I never really thought of before is that the two approaches, although they are tied by a concept, are actually very, very on two opposite ends of the scale. One is the improv scene is completely, it is spontaneous. I'm not going to think about it before it happens. We're going to do it. And the composition is very, very carefully worked out and labored over, note by note, write, erase, change, move this here. It's
interesting because it brings us back also to the games thing, which was your way of organizing
improvisers.
Improvising thing, which you just described as being way out, completely unorganized.
Right.
So it's one of the things that I've remarked on before about Masada that I think is so interesting is that it brings together your composition brain and your improvisation brain.
Yeah.
And they are at these sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. And yet when they meet, it's this sparks that sort of come out of it. And it raises the band another level, too. That we're not only grappling with your organized composerly thoughts, but we're also grappling with you as an improviser on the stage with us, trying to
maybe that combination of the two things at once is what people really respond to, why they really like to see me on stage with a group rather than compositions where I'm not on stage. I think after many, many years of trying to get people to understand that I can get a band on stage without me playing and it's still going to kill and be 110%. I think I've made some headway. But nevertheless, one really flattering example, if I may say it, it was in some review or some blog somewhere of one of these European gigs that we've been doing this year, the Zorn at 60, which starts with the Song Project. And then there's the piece for piano, bass, and drums that's all written, and then there's the Holy Visions for five voices, and then there's the Alchemist String Quartet, and then Moonchild comes out with Mike Patton, and there's an amazing rock set for four musicians. Then the Dreamers come out and do this beautiful set, and then Electric Masada comes out, and then I finally come out with the horn at the end. Mm-hmm. And I come out and I play with Electric Masada, and we do 15 minutes or 20 minutes, right, something like that. And this woman saw all of this music and was like, wow, this stuff was so amazing. But when that guy got up on stage with his band,
uh-oh,
you just could immediately see the power that this guy was wielding.
Oh, great.
Just, you know, in terms of the cueing, in terms of everybody watching me, in terms of, again, the community and the respect that I have and the loyalty that I've earned and that I show to other musicians, I think that was really
great.
It was really great to read that, you know, because I don't think of myself as an amazing sax player. I use it as a tool,
okay,
in a way.
To that end, can I play a track? Just a short.
Always love to play tracks.
So, like, just to tie off this aspect of the conversation, I want to play something from Classic Guide to Strategy, the solo record that you made many years ago.
Yeah, and just 30 seconds on that. It's interesting. I've never written a piece for myself to play. Solo sax. It's always complete improv.
It's completely improvised. It's also, there's no overdubs and no splicing or anything.
Yes.
Right? It's all live.
All live.
So I want to play this track, Kondo Toshinori, which I guess is dedicated to...
To Kondo Toshinori, yeah. A dear friend of mine, a trumpet player.
About the piece or why? Not really. So, and was this all alto saxophone?
I can't remember which this is. I think there's a lot of game calls on this.
And maybe I'll ask you one more question, then we'll go on to George Patton.
Beautiful! Thank you.
We're back. Classic Guide to Strategy.
I don't know if you can ever come back after that. I don't know. We're someplace else now, man.
I was snapping my fingers over here, tap dancing, and had my top hat and cane ready to go.
It's definitely unique. I think that's the music that, you know, Pat Metheny said he heard when he was driving his car and he had to pull up on the side of the road to listen to it. And then he called the station and said, "What is going on there?" There's certainly a lot of focus. That is definitely a level of virtuosity that I could never get to again with those game calls. I'm moving so quickly.
So it's the end of that period we were talking about.
Yeah.
Before we played it, you weren't sure whether it was game calls and saxophone.
This is definitely
both. Confirmed that,
yeah.
You must have had a table with all the stuff laid out.
Always a table. And it was laid out in a very methodical way. Everything always was in the same place. Mm-hmm. When I did these performances, there was like a towel and then all those calls always, right, in the same place, kind of categorized. Mm-hmm. The goose calls over here, you know, this and that, and then a small bowl of water,
right,
and the sax in my lap. And mouthpieces over here. And man, but I'm going from thing to thing
really
fast. Lightning fast. I can't even believe it, but every one of those techniques, I still know how to make all those sounds.
Well, that's great.
It's very visual to me when I hear those sounds. Mm. That's something else.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's amazing. But I mean, that's what I was talking about when I said all that stuff that you practiced. That still
never practiced any of that. None of that was ever practiced at home. All of those techniques happened in improvising with people.
With people. So what made you want to do a solo record then?
Well, that's a challenge, isn't it? That's one
so
of the things that
another,
you need to do. That's, yeah, you know, like writing a string quartet. You need to do that. Writing a, mm-hmm, you know, I mean, you need to do that. So that's what I did.
Interesting. And was that piece a response to Kondo Toshinori in any way, would you say, now that you've been listening to it again?
Does it remind me of Kondo?
Well, was it a dedication for him in any specific programmatic way?
Let's I can't hear that
not
quite
really
so well.
But you were playing with him at the time. And
yeah, before that. I think he had gone back to Japan by then. But yeah, he was a good friend and amazing trumpet player, incredible trumpet player.
And made a beautiful solo record of his own.
Did indeed.
Wow, interesting. Okay, so I have promised that I was going to ask you about General George Patton. And I feel like I'll be letting my podcast listeners down if I don't.
Well,
so
I'm in enough trouble as it is, man.
So, no, not the movie. We were talking about band leading. We were talking about
Ben Young asked me. Yeah, Ben Young asked me up at KCR last week. I was there with Phil Schapp and Ben Young.
Amazing.
And
I wish I'd heard that.
We did some good radio, man. Some good radio. And Ben, at the end of the whole, no, it wasn't at the end of the program. It was when Phil kind of, he had his first hour and then Ben took over. And then he asked about who was inspiring as a band leader.
Hmm.
Like, and he expected me to say, you know, Duke Ellington. Or so I said, Miles Davis, you know. I said, well, I'm going to surprise you. But as far as being a leader, the most inspiring person to me, the person I've gotten the most out of, is General George Patton. And he was like, yeah, I am surprised.
Well, he had a great big band.
One of those territory groups in the 30s,
yeah,
man,
exactly,
of Texas. Man.
A lot of territory.
Well, you know, Patton has written a lot about leadership and how to inspire groups and how to earn loyalty and how to take care of the groups and how to share suffering and how to lead from the front, not push from the back. I mean, these are all like, you know, very simple things, but very profound. And I'm still doing a lot of reading of his writings and biographies. And when I'm on the road with 30, 40 cats in the band and I've really got to keep people under control, I, you know, think about that because it reminds me that I'm part of a team and that I have responsibility and that everybody else has responsibility. Yeah. And if someone, again, is not rowing the boat or if someone has a disharmonious disposition, I've got to roll them right out of the organization.
Any particular book that you would recommend?
to people
of the Patton writings.
Anything about him is really going to be
books
interesting.
About him, like his
books
biography.
About him. Yes, there were people that actually rolled with him. Mm. There's a guy, Porter Williamson, who wrote a book, General Patton's Principles, I think it's called. There's a silly book that's actually got a lot of great quotes in it that's something like, you know, strategic lessons on leadership from George Patton that's kind of aimed at a business crowd or something, the way a lot of businessmen, I think, in the 80s started reading, you know, the Book of Five Rings, you know, The Art of War, these
right.
kind of tactical.
Sun Tzu.
Yeah. And you know, the battle is won before the first shot is fired. Mm. This is true of music as well. You know, the musical concert is successful even before, you know, we even have to play a note. I know that it's going to slam.
Wow.
Like we're playing a Masada Marathon on Sunday. I don't know when this podcast will actually become, but on the 15th of September.
This may probably... after that. But,
okay. But I know that it's not...
quite a number.
We've done a number
of
them.
They're always great.
I know all the musicians. I know that I can rely on them. I know, you know, how to put them in, you know, in the right sequence. Sequencing things is also something that's that I'm very adept at, putting things in a proper sequence so that they kind of always, things sound fresh. So, you know, you put the band together, you give them enough time to rehearse, you make sure that they have, you know, they're comfortable, they have dry socks.
Right,
you know,
right. Care, feeding, and maintenance.
It's all part of
and
the job.
Good meal.
Good meal. And then when it's time for me to get up there and play, I have to slam it. I have to be inspiring.
But everybody else has to, too. They know they have to rise.
I've got to bring them up. Because only if I can do it, if I fall on my face, forget it. The whole thing falls apart. So it's like, you know, you have to practice what you preach. You have to really be able to back it up.
Isn't there an Eddie Harris book that you used to talk about band leading?
No, that was like a bunch of
was like
of jokes.
Astrological...
Yeah, it was more like a bunch of jokes.
Okay, all right, but you had some
The quote I remember
won't be repeated here, unless you want.
The one quote he had about the Virgo band leader. The Virgo
right.
band leader is someone who will make you work harder than you ever worked in your whole life, while he coasts. But I have amended that because I know that I can't coast. When I go out, you know, with these 5-hour shows with 40 people, I work 15 hours straight, nonstop, no rest, no food. And I deliberately don't take food.
I can't believe it.
I don't take food deliberately because I know a lot of cats out there maybe don't have time to get the food here and there. I'm not going to treat myself to something that other people can't treat themselves to. I have to set an example. So I've got to constantly be full of energy. I've got to be positive. I have to have all the answers at all the times. Attack, attack, attack. Just constantly move forward.
I want to play a track from a very recent CD, and maybe we'll just listen to a little bit of this piece, but this is this Rambeau CD that...
it's one of my favorites.
...out recently with 4 different pieces on it, but we'll listen to just a little bit of Illuminations.
Thank you.
So we just listened to a small piece of Illuminations, but
Well, that piece is unique because it's the first time I. This is such a simple formula. Yeah. It's amazing to me that it never happened before. The piano part is completely written,
right.
And the bass and drums improvise along with the piano.
Who did that? One person that I know of is Mary Lou Williams.
Did she do that?
Made a record where she composed another piano part for a classical pianist, and then she improvised along with it.
Oh, but she on piano.
Two pianos.
So, bass and drums. Yeah.
No, just duo.
Okay, that's
so
cool.
This is really interesting because it's Stephen Gosling, an incredible,
amazing
classical pianist, yeah. and so he's reading here.
Yeah.
And then in the rhythm section, it's Trevor Dunn and Kenny Wollison.
Right.
And completely improvised.
As with anything, you know. When we play a Masada tune, we play the head, and then we don't just go do whatever we want. We do what's appropriate for the framework that melody or that initial head implies. We follow through.
Right.
The same thing with this. I kind of described to Kenny and Trevor as if they were playing like a big band chart. Mm-hmm. It's all written, and you gotta support what's happening in the big band, and the big band of course is the piano, and it's all there.
Listen in advance to the piano player,
yes, they listened a lot, and Trevor actually came in with detailed notes of harmonically where he wanted to go.
Great.
And Kenny was really prepared on where to stop, where to start. But I said, you know, you can go into time, you could just play open, you can go maybe here, go to brushes, maybe here use sticks, maybe, you know, we talked about different things here and there.
That's great.
But ultimately what's happening is they're kind of like following the piano part, but not too slavishly where it becomes boring. They're going against it at times. They're, you know, improvising, but improvising with taste.
As you're talking about it, there's a little corollary, and I don't know, this might be way off base, but you tell me, like the early Ornette Coleman quartets, when Ornette Coleman and Don Cherry play those melodies, I don't think that Ornette wrote parts for the rhythm section.
I'm sure he didn't.
Charlie Hayden,
yeah,
and Billy Higgins or Ed Blackwell would figure out what to do, and they've figured out something really brilliant.
I'm not sure whether Ornette had instructions for them or whether they just came up with their own parts. That I'm not clear on.
Right, and sometimes the way that the rhythm section parts work with the written stuff is really counterintuitive.
Astonishing, yes, completely.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
And so in a way, that's in a much smaller format. In the case of this piece,
it's a long 15-minute head.
Yeah.
Well, you know, again, what I was thinking of is something that's going to gas the players.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that, you know, that seat sitting in Illuminations, either as a drummer or a bass player, is a very exciting seat to sit in.
And for the piano player as well.
And for the piano player, after he did this, Steve was like, man, I should have bass and drums at every gig I do. This is amazing. Like, he was really stoked. He never played like that before.
Wow.
So it was something that was very exciting for the players. And again, as a role as composer is to come up with something that excites the players and acts again as a catalyst and platform for them to do what they do best.
And it creates this piece that's sort of in its own world.
It is.
For us outside as the listener, it's just kind of like, okay, here's a new thing that I have to figure out what is going on.
A lot of people thought the piano was all improvised.
Right.
You know, and then I say,
in your piano concerto, remember, I heard it on the radio one night, and I was like, okay, wait a minute, you know, because there's a long section where it sounds like the person is soloing and improvising, and it's all written.
It's all written. In fact, Alvin Singleton, who a very dear friend and great composer who teaches down, I'm not sure where he's teaching right now, but he had a course on improvisation and composition, and he told me, I'm teaching your piece Aporias, the piano concerto, in my improvisation course. And I said, I don't understand. What do you mean? He said, well, you know, the improvisation, the piano. I said, Alvin, the piano is all written, every note. He went, what?
Okay, so now we'll play a little bit of that, too.
Thank you.
Aporeus, beautiful music. Speaking of band leading and thinking of new contexts and different things to do, I want to close out and thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me,
we'll
Dave.
Have to do it again. I feel like we're just scratching the surface.
There's just so much to talk about. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Always interesting. But please.
But I'm going to play the first track of your Naked City record, Absinthe. Anything you want to say about that?
This is interesting because... Well, Naked City had done a lot of different things up to this point. This was, I think, the last record that we had made. We had covered classical music, movie soundtracks. We did all those kind of short hardcore punk things. We did the radio record, which is kind of related to the kind of Dreamers pieces that I'm doing now. We did a whole improvised record. We really covered a lot of ground. And everyone used to joke about the Naked City Quartet. Because, again, you know, the Virgo band leader, I would not really play very much. They would be doing all the playing. And we went into the studio. I wanted to do a real audiophile record. Mm. And I think Joe Furler recorded this one. And we went to Electric Ladyland, and we did it on reel-to-reel, like analog. It was, like, really serious. And the project for this was to do a record where there was no notes, per se. No written, there were no chords, it was all sounds. I wanted to do something that was all kind of textural. And the music was written, it was all written down, and I needed to explain the techniques. I had Joey didn't touch the drum set the whole session.
Right.
In fact, we went shopping on Canal Street to get his setup, which was, you know, a bunch of, you know, metal BBs
ball bearings,
all these different,
all
these different kinds of objects that he was manipulating. And for Frizzell, for this first piece, I had Frizzell restring his guitar with all E strings tuned within the space of a minor or major second, six microtones between that. And... He's doing that, and Frith is doing that as well. He had a different tuning on his bass, on the bass, and Frizzell did a kind of solo using that E string guitar. He fell in love with that guitar, and he used it later on some of his own records. But he did some really amazing playing on this, and yeah, it's a really beautiful track.
Thanks, man.
All right,
John.
Ba-boom.
Great stuff, and once again, you are listening to part two of an interview between Dave Douglas and John Zorn here on A Noise from the Deep, the Greenleaf Music Podcast. And that brings us to the end of the show. Once again, please don't be afraid to stop past the iTunes store and give us a review and a rating. We'd love to hear from you at podcast@greenleafmusic.com. We've got a bunch more episodes on the way. We're having a great time doing it. Thanks again. Bye.